and welcome to the fifth episode of Tomorrow Never Knows, the podcast on women, history, gender, politics and everything else. I'm Emma London.
And I'm Charlotte Lydia Riley.
And today we're going to be talking about women and health, or health in particular with a gender and woman perspective.
Yes, this is the first of a two-part episode on issues to do with gender and health and illness.
Yes. So, why is this interesting?
So, I mean, as with all of the topics we talk about, I feel like the first reason this is interesting to me is because I am a woman who has a body and have experienced health issues, chronic health issues and various things like that. I think it's interesting to me from a slightly more academic perspective because, firstly, women in the public sphere and perhaps women particularly in politics, which is again where my research tends to focus, have particular issues sometimes around health and healthcare. Women's bodies are not assumed to be the default sort of body that you go around in public in, if that makes sense. And so they have kind of constantly run up against issues to do with their health and their bodies and the way that people perceive their bodies and their relationship to health.
Yeah.
And also the work that I do on the developing world and international development often has quite a strong focus on the health of women and girls and healthcare initiatives for women and girls. So that's why I'm interested in it. Why are you interested in it?
Well, it's the same. I mean, I don't really work so very much on women and health. I have taught eugenics, which I'm sure will come up here. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've taught the history of eugenics.
all the
bad stuff about eugenics. I haven't taught how to do it. Or, you know, that you should do it. Oh, that's disgusting. But anyway, so that's, I suppose, my academic interest in it. But I am a woman and I have been ill. I don't have any chronic things, I don't think. But where do we start? Shall we start with the concept of messy bodies?
Yes, messy bodies. So I think this has become a kind of shorthand for me that I use a lot. And I think this is partly inspired by Rachel Moss.
Yes.
Who is an academic who's on Twitter, at Many Snowballs. We'll put a link to her on our newsletter. But she has been really good, I think quite pioneering in a way, in writing about the messiness of women's bodies in public spaces and obviously in the particular context of academia, because she is an academic. And that's, you know, why I maybe particularly empathise with her writing about this, because I'm also an academic and I empathise and sympathise with a lot of the things that she raises.
Yes. Yeah, she writes incredibly well. She wrote something in the summer about having blood clots that I thought was mm-hmm. really, really fascinating and great. It's very unusual that people... I think that she is so brave for doing this. And not... I don't... You know, she's quite kind of pioneering in the way that she does it. I don't want to heap lots of pressure on her. But it's more applauding her from the sidelines and yeah. really finding it inspirational. It's great that she takes the space that she has, and she has quite a lot of Twitter followers, and she's mm-hmm. got a really excellent blog, and she talks about these things that I think makes academia more approachable for a lot of people. It can be quite ableist.
Yes, it definitely academia. Can. And I think that's something... I mean, I think academia is an interesting space to think about the health of individuals, because on one hand, it is profoundly ableist, not least because academia... Not least from a kind of mental health perspective, as well as an illness perspective, there are lots of issues around access in academia in all kinds of ways. So, like, the debate about whether students should be allowed to have laptops in lecture theatres, for example, is actually a profoundly ableist debate, because some people rely on that kind of technology to be able to participate in learning.
Yes.
A lot of the language used unthinkingly around, not necessarily academia, but around education is quite... ableist. I mean, languages around intelligence is, you know, can be profoundly problematic. But also, you know, again, and I know I keep banging on about this, and I think, you know, I think Rachel's work is profoundly feminist.
Yes.
Because it's about, you know, it's about coming back to that sort of second wave slogan that the personal is political.
Yes.
It's about centering the idea that your personal experiences might shape your experience of the workplace, your ability to contribute to your career.
Yes.
And acknowledging that isn't unprofessional.
Exactly.
That bringing kind of bringing your body to work is not an unprofessional thing to do, but actually you're often made to feel like it is unprofessional. It's unprofessional to have a body that can't work 24-hour days. It's unprofessional to have a body that needs toilet breaks. It's unprofessional to have a body that might put you in hospital or mean that you have to have sick leave.
Yes. And I suppose it's not just about having disabilities particular or particular illnesses. A lot of it is to do with, I feel academics are very lucky in that we don't actually do very hard physical toiling work, right? Yes. So compare me to someone who goes on sweeping the street, then I'll get a repetitive strain injury from sitting at a desk, but it's a completely different thing from someone who has to sweep a street or lift patients in and out of beds. You know, there's, you know, I mean, if we're going to start talking about retirement age, then maybe academics who use their brains can retire later than people who use their physical strength at work. But that doesn't mean that academics don't also have bodies involved in doing their work. And it can be something as mundane or not heavy as travelling. I mean, you commute a lot. How many hours a week do you commute, Charlotte?
This term, I commute about 3 hours a day. And probably 3.5 hours a day, 4 days a week.
Yeah, that's...
So what's that, 14? 14 hours a week.
Too sleep deprived to be able to count. But you get up very early.
I get up very early. I get home very late. I spend more than a working day on trains, basically. And actually, specifically... So that, you know, that academia has a lot of commuters, a lot of people who commute long distance because university jobs are obviously only available in universities and they're all in specific places. We start looking for our first job later in life than other people. You know, I finished my PhD when I was 27, so I was looking for a job at a point where I had already put down roots in the city that I live in. I couldn't move me and my partner somewhere else to find work. London, where I live, is where my archives are, where my primary sources are, where the British Library is, so it's not a hardship for me to live here. But, you know, a lot of people commute and commute long distances. It does funny things. It does funny things to your perception of work, but it also does bad things to your body. I have sciatica from when I was writing my PhD.
Oh, really?
Oh, I have terrible posture. So I, like, spending hours and hours writing my PhD.
If there was a camera here, listeners would see that we both straighten our backs up, as Charlotte said.
The second someone says posture, you have to sit up straight. It's partly from sitting and writing a PhD and doing long hours sitting, working from home. It's also from archives. Archives are not ergonomically designed.
Oh, God, no.
I mean, really, really, to an extent where I think actually, you know, archives need to think seriously about access conditions.
Yes.
The National Archives is accessible to somebody in a wheelchair. There are ways that you can access the National Archives, for example, in a wheelchair or if you have access requirements. But... you know, the chairs and the tables, the way they physically fit together does not make for a comfortable day's work.
No, I've had terrible times because I tend to go away to archives. I have archives in South Africa and Sweden, and I tend to be there for 3 weeks and I sit at the same desk every day and, you know, it's terrible.
But also sitting on the train for 3.5 hours a day is making my sciatica worse. So my students have had to get used to me standing often in seminars. So when we're all sitting around tables, I'm actually standing and walking around often at the front of the class.
Yeah.
Because I can't bring myself to sit for another hour or 2 hours or 3 hours.
Yeah.
Some of my seminar classes are 3 hours long.
Oh, wow.
I can't sit for that length of time anymore.
So that's our history of messy bodies, I suppose. Where do we go from here? I mean, part of the problem, I think, that we need to talk about is that women's bodies are not necessarily taken very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
It's inconvenient. A lot of the stuff to do with our physical health.
Yeah.
It's rare that you get someone in the medical profession who really takes the time to understand mm-hmm. what you're talking about. I mean, there's all sorts of statistics about women's undiagnosed pain.
Yeah.
That women suffer heart attacks undiagnosed.
Well, also that the whole medical profession for a long time has been... diagnosis has been organised not only around men, but about white men as well. Mm. So there is evidence of, for example, different pain thresholds, not only by gender, but also by ethnic group. And that this isn't really understood or has not traditionally been understood by the medical profession. So, for example, when people talk about being in pain, the level of pain, it tends to be kind of understood in terms of how white men experience pain. Mm. And women have lower pain thresholds than men, so pain hurts women earlier.
Oh, okay.
Redheaded people also have very low pain thresholds, interestingly. But also that... kind of diagnosis. So women experience heart attacks in different ways. The heart attack symptoms for women are different than the symptoms for men.
Mm.
But the symptoms that you know of as being a heart attack, so pain up and down your arm, crushing feeling in your chest, shortness of breath, they're male heart attack symptoms. Mm. The reason that women have so many undiagnosed heart attacks is because we have not been taught as a culture how women do experience them.
Mm. How do women experience them?
As soon as I started saying this, I thought I should know for sure how women experience them. I think women are more likely to get jaw pain.
Oh.
And I think women are, although we should look this up and actually kind of...
We'll
link to the actual evidence. I have a feeling that men experience heart attacks in more of a kind of chest pain. Like the kind of classic sense of having chest pain that's to do with heart attacks is a male symptom.
Okay.
And that women are more likely to have kind of slightly more baffling symptoms that might not necessarily immediately suggest to you that you're having a heart attack.
It's interesting. I don't think I know any woman who has had a heart attack.
No.
But that doesn't mean that that's true, I suppose.
I mean, of course, that's the other aspect of it, isn't it? That, you know, men have specific health concerns as well. You know, men have specific problems with health. Men are more likely to have heart attacks. Men are more likely to have high blood pressure.
Are very unlikely to realise that they have prostate cancer until it's too late.
Men, you know, are actually the biggest, you know, obviously one of the biggest causes of death for young men is suicide.
Yeah.
Men are more likely to struggle longer with, or, you know, there is some evidence that men have particular problems in accessing mental health care.
Yes.
Because of the gendered expectations around talking around emotions and feelings mean that it's hard for men, particularly young men, to access mental health care. And actually that for many young men, they're more likely, mental health issues are sometimes more likely to manifest themselves in different sorts of symptoms. So for example, men who have problems with violence often actually, you know, need to, could be treated through mental health.
Yeah.
Issues and things. So there are, you know, it's not just that women are treated badly by the healthcare system. The way in which we experience illness is profoundly gendered for men and women.
How about the facts about austerity politics and ill health that we talked about before? I mean, that was, we're recording this at the end of November.
Mm-hmm.
And is it like 2 weeks ago, a week ago, 2 weeks recently. Ago, that it was announced at the BMJ... So a very authoritative source says that there's been 120,000 excess deaths.
Since 2010.
Since 2010 in Britain because of austerity politics.
Yeah.
And that is the impact on cuts on human bodies and minds.
Yeah, particularly cuts to the social care budget.
Yeah.
I mean, it's extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, this also kind of... This comes on top of kind of long-term United Nations concerns about the British government's ability to deal with people with disabilities. Mm. And again, you know, austerity politics often impact on women in specific ways. Maya Goodfellow has written some very good stuff about how austerity impacts particularly on women of colour. In Britain, women of colour are more likely to be reliant on state-funded services, and when they're cut, they are likely to feel the cuts more deeply. Mm. I mean, you know, Jeremy Hunt in Britain has, I feel like, almost become a kind of figure of fun because he's become sort of renowned for being so inept in ways, and that I feel quite conflicted about this because actually it kind of takes away from the fact that NHS cuts are killing people, are literally killing people in Britain. Mm. The idea that, you know, we have this kind of incredibly inept health secretary, and actually the idea that he's inept has just become a bit of a joke rather than a really specific target for...
Yes, it's like the second Boris Johnson of the current cabinet.
Exactly. I mean, I know that's not entirely... I mean, there are lots of really good works, good organisations doing good work on lobbying for healthcare and for the rights of disabled people. Mm. And groups like Sisters Uncut, for example, who are doing work lobbying for women to access services and things like this. But I feel like the way that Hunt... He almost kind of... I feel like sometimes he escapes press attention because he's just... We just have this kind of narrative of him being inept.
I also feel like it speaks to my inner conspiracy theorist as well, that there's a lot of stuff that can happen behind closed doors if you kind of take away the responsibility for the person in charge.
Yes, that's true.
Which we're kind of doing by saying that he is... Mm-hmm. He's not suitable for his job. There is a lot of the privatisation of the NHS is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And while we're focusing elsewhere, there was something I saw on Twitter a few days ago that Jeremy Hunt was talking to non-medics about the NHS,
mm-hmm.
and he was talking about the NHS as us, and this person was saying, it's not us. I mean, have nothing to do with the NHS, you're just destroying it. But 120,000 excess deaths in the past 7 years. It's 120,000. That's like half the size of the city of York, isn't it? Or something like that?
It's almost as big as Peterborough. Bigger than the whole of, I think the size of the whole of Tower Hamlets, maybe?
Yeah.
Because it's an extraordinary figure. And it's something I feel like I actually don't feel I can talk about with any great authority because it makes me so angry.
Yeah.
And because I know so many people, I have so many friends and family members and myself who have had to access various aspects of NHS care over the last 10 years. So like since I've been an adult, since I've been accessing NHS care as an adult, and so, you know, doing so myself, piloting myself through this system. And, you know, the thing... the kind of constant experience is that the care you get generally is very good, although obviously not everybody has this experience. Some people do not have, some people have a difficult relationship with doctors or are not taken seriously by medical professionals. My experience has always been the care that you get is very good, but the kind of actual process by which you access any of the care is just a labyrinthine nightmare. And everything, kind of having to constantly wait for things, having to constantly chase things up, having appointments cancelled and rescheduled, having test results go missing because everything's done by third-party groups or...
Harriet Harman writes about this in her autobiography, that was one of the things she was working on. She was the Shadow Secretary for Social Security at one point, I think in the late 80s.
Mm.
And it was one of the things that she was most enraged by was the long waiting lists on the NHS and that people died while waiting for operations. Quite, not controversial or very high-tech operations, but very standard routine procedures. And I sort of feel like we're getting there again. I've recently, this is incredibly mundane in comparison to anything, but I have to have my feet assessed and because of this hypermobility thing. And it's the letters you get these days. This has changed in the past few years. The letters you get these days about how to book an appointment, that you're on a waiting list and all sorts of things, they're quite like semi-threatening in a way. It sort of says in bold at the top that if you don't let us know within 10 days, we're assuming that you're no longer interested in the procedure. And it doesn't give people who have difficulties navigating these spaces.
No.
Or a very busy, hectic life. And I don't really count mine as very busy and hectic, although, it pretty much, I fill my days.
Yeah.
But I mostly work from home.
People who do shift work, anything like this.
Exactly.
I mean, my experience...
You have to call within a set amount of hours, and you can't call at lunchtime because then there's hardly anyone there and there's long queues. It's not really a system that works very well, and I have no expertise in how it should be improved, but all I can say is that it definitely needs more money.
I mean, as a child, I remember NHS waiting times being a big issue. Like, as a child who was a child, and so therefore not that involved in politics, waiting times, both in terms of waiting lists for operations and then waiting times in A&E being a big thing. As the oldest of five children, I spent quite a lot of time in accident and emergency departments.
I bet.
There was one summer where my mother took one of us in every single Friday in summer holidays. Because, you know, for various kind of injuries, I think, you know, if we hadn't been so... such chatty children who were so interested in telling doctors exactly how we had achieved all of these injuries, then the doctors might have been quite suspicious. But, and there was always, you know, the NHS accident and emergency departments often have a kind of scrolling display somewhere that tells you what the current waiting time is. Mm. And the thing was always, you know, is it more than 4 hours? Is the waiting time more than 4 hours? And that's sort of the cutoff point for being too long, which is, you know, which is incredible. I think one of the things that I've often spoken with friends about with lots and lots of things in Britain around social services, not just the NHS, but with every type of social service in Britain, is that essentially I am now able to navigate these things because I have an enormous amount of middle-class cultural capital.
Yeah.
And I've spoken to friends who have spent time in hospital or who have kind of chronic health conditions that require, you know, lots of appointments and management, or who have, you know, children with special educational needs, for example, like lots of different ways in which you have to interact with the social care system, or parents who are elderly and need care.
Mm.
And the sort of the general narrative is always that, you know, the people who do the caring are wonderful, the people who kind of provide the service are wonderful, the system is difficult to navigate, but that the system relies on you having an enormous amount of cultural capital in order to be able to get things done.
Yeah.
And you have to be able to, and, you know, and this is also very gendered, because I think, you know, often when, if women are trying to access healthcare, if women are being kind of firm and demanding about accessing healthcare, for example, this is often read as being hysterical or hypochondriac, particularly in terms of accessing healthcare for children. I think women who are trying to get access to healthcare for their kids often...
Oh, really?
I think often feel like they're being sort of stereotyped as hysterical mothers.
Oh, okay. I've never tried. I only take my daughter in for injections. She hasn't been to the GP for anything else, but yeah.
But yeah, I think there's a fine line where you need a huge amount of cultural capital to be able to make demands for things. You need to have this kind of middle-class pushiness to push yourself through waiting lists or to ask for treatments or to ask to be referred for things.
Have you changed your title on the NHS by?
I haven't.
You haven't?
Hilariously, my title for the NHS for some reason is SS.
Oh, yes.
So I get all of my letters addressed to SS Charlotte Riley. My partner found one of them quite recently and was like, are you actually a boat? Like, is this... So I, not only have I not changed my title to doctor, but my title is something... I have no idea why my title is SS, but it is.
That's hilarious. Because if anyone follows me on Twitter, you will know that every now and then I talk about the need for... I seriously recommend women with PhDs to change their title on the NHS to doctor, because it's made a vast improvement in how I'm treated, which is infuriating.
Yeah.
Slightly understandable. I talked to my sister-in-law about this. She is a GP, and she said, well, you know, you sort of feel like it's a person who can judge your judgment, because we're automatically assumed to be medics.
No one
really looks at us and think, oh, you must be a historian. They just automatically assume that we have some sort of medical speciality or something. And it was while I was pregnant and I was going to the hospital all of the time, and I was like, well, you might as well update the title. And it has made quite a big difference.
That's incredible.
So, you know, I'm not suggesting that everyone should go out and get PhDs, but I think we should all think about why a woman with doctor in her title gets taken a bit more seriously.
I mean, what I'd be really interested to know is this the case for men? You know, is it a gendered thing, or is it medical professionals versus non-medical professionals thing?
Can a man who listens to this, who has changed his title on the NHS, let us know?
Yeah, get in touch, tell us.
Get in touch, all the usual places. TNKpod?
TNKpod.
TNKpod. God, never learn. On Twitter and all of that. But yeah, no, it'd be fascinating to know.
It would. As well, one of the other issues of kind of health and illness that we were talking about was sort of mental health.
Yes.
And I think this, I was partly thinking about this because of the because of the data about austerity and cuts, because obviously one of the areas that's really seen cuts in provision is mental health services, I think, or it feels like that. It feels like that from someone who has, you know, tried to access these services. Actually, often, sometimes for students as well, has had to try to access these services. Mm. It feels like there have been cuts that have made a big difference. And I think mental health in academia is really interesting because I think on one hand, actually, academia is a space where people can often be quite open about mental health issues that they've had. Mm. Not least because, and this is, you know, very problematic, we've talked previously on this podcast about the kind of the kind of stereotype of the genius brain in a jar man,
yeah,
who is the, you know, the wonderful professor who has no kind of practical knowledge or experience but is a wonderful mathematician or fantastic sociologist or whatever. And actually that narrative sometimes glamorizes mental illness, particularly depression, I think, as being somehow connected to creativity.
Yeah.
That this is a sort of a drive for these people, or that it might be something that demonstrates, you know, incredible depths of this person's psyche or something.
And not just academia, I mean, any creative.
Yeah.
You know, if you think about artists or writers outside the academy.
Absolutely.
It's definitely the poor mental health is glamorized by fans. And in the biographies of a lot of people of note.
Yes, and I would say much more so for men than for women, because again, I think that women having, I mean, with some notable exceptions, but women who have mental health struggles, apart from anything else, there's tend to be the descriptions tend to be of, you know, hysteria and anxiety rather than depression, which is kind of coded as a sort of male genius thing. Now, obviously, like, this is ridiculous, right? Like, depression does not make you a better artist or a better academic.
And lots of women have depression.
And lots of men have problems with anxiety. Mm. But, you know, it is part of the narrative sometimes about these people. I think the way academia deals with this really badly is that, firstly, as we've talked about previously, there is very little, increasingly little mental health support for professionals working in academia. We have support for our students, thankfully, but we have very little support for academics who want to access.
So most academics would have to access state resources rather than employer resources.
Yes, it's very
But that's
hard.
Not necessarily that unusual, though.
No,
if you think
of course.
About most people who work or are employed, they would not, their companies would not necessarily have the provision. They might have a good HR department who can steer them in the right direction.
Well,
I think
often a good occupational health, you know, they're often often big. I mean, universities are
suppose.
Enormous. Universities might employ 20,000 people, and an organisation that employed 20,000 people, I think, probably would have some mental health provision.
And also it's not just academics who need to access mental health provision at universities. There
are
lots of other people
Absolutely.
Who suffer from the same thought processes.
I think the way, you know, it's also deeply, no, it's not just deeply problematic because this is glamorized. You know, depression is not a glamorous illness. Anxiety is certainly not a glamorous experience. So the glamorization of it is just really ridiculous. But it's also, you know, actually, again, the ways in which universities are shifting and the sort of narratives we have in place about what it means to be a good academic often lead to very poor mental health practices. Mm. Selena Todd, who's a historian at Oxford, wrote a very good blog post about the pressures to work 24/7 as an academic, the blurring between work and life for academics, which we've talked about before, but also the idea that driving yourself to beyond your capabilities or working with depression, you know, how badly we deal with these issues in academia, that there's often the assumption that if you're kind of a happy, cheerful sort of person who has a good work-life balance, that means you're somehow not a serious academic.
Yeah.
And that you need to be this kind of tortured soul who spends their entire life, you know, deeply immersed in their work. Which, I mean, I don't know, this is also partly me having obviously a huge case of imposter syndrome, but I just don't see why I just don't think anyone would spend their life immersed in the work that I do. It just doesn't seem that important to me. I'm sure there is a way for me to think, you know, I like the work I do, I like the research I do, but the idea that I would sort of sublimate all of the rest of my life to it. It's just
but I think it's also a massive glamorization of the genius and how the genius works. I think a lot of geniuses out there in the history of the world and currently walking among us don't actually work the way that we assume that they do. They have families. They have, you know, even Marx went to the pub all the time.
Well, also, geniuses are always men, aren't they? There's never the way that people talk about, you know, geniuses are not real. People who are geniuses don't exist.
No.
But imaginary geniuses are always men.
Mm.
And, you know, they all have wives who sort out all of their daily lives for them. And no one cares.
They do their footnotes and referencing.
Yeah. And no one, you know, and no one cares if they have terrible work-life balance. Or
a soup stain down their front.
Yeah. But the idea that, you know, academia is, I think, can be deeply problematic for kind of making people internalise a lot of pressures. You spend a lot of time on your own. If you do have problems with anxiety or depression, I think it can be massively amplified by kind of what an academic career can demand of you. Yeah. Not least the enormous amount of time you spend on your own and kind of very internalised pressures. And, you know, a kind of work, it's a sort of work where your judgment of your work can feel very personalised.
Mm.
If you produce a, you know, 12,000 word article that you've been working on for years and then someone criticises it, that can feel very internalised. It can feel very kind of personalised, that criticism. And that can be very hard to manage. And I don't think there is really any kind of guidance early in your career for how to make sure that that isn't something that completely destroys you.
Yeah.
It can be very, very hard to learn how to keep a healthy perspective on work when a lot of the time, kind of culturally, you're being told that your work is everything and that your life should be kind of completely.
Yes, and I think what makes academia different in this perspective is that those pressures, I think, are present for many of the kind of middle class professions or any professions absolutely. At all, but they continue for a lot longer in academia.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was a young journalist, I had those pressures for about 2 or 3 years, and then I was pretty settled and it was all going fine. And whereas as an academic, those pressures kind of continue. I don't know, maybe they even continue beyond you getting a chair. I'm now expecting Charlotte to become a professor one day. No pressure. I think that makes academia a bit unique. I'm sure that there are other professions that are similar. So if anyone wants to contact us and tell us about particular, maybe policing, maybe nursing, I don't know.
Yes.
But we started the podcast or this episode talking about Rachel Moss. And she, I think in the summer, it might be more recent than that, but she tweeted something that I thought was quite good and that we should maybe talk a little bit about. And that is that vanity. I can't actually remember the whole tweet off by heart, but the gist was that vanity can be a good both defense mechanism and like a rebellion against messy bodies and ill health.
Yeah.
So actually primping and preening yourself and looking after yourself in the way you see best. And Rachel has amazing dresses and great makeup and all of that. So that obviously, hopefully works for Rachel.
I think there's a sense in which, definitely. You know, and this goes back, I think, a few episodes ago we were talking about clothing and dress in the workplace, and I said that, you know, there's an element to which this is self-care. I personally think that on a bad day I can replace, you know, 5 hours of sleep with eyeliner and sometimes, you know, I can replace I can wear lipstick rather than having to have a personality when I'm very tired or, you know, very busy or very stressed. Actually, yeah, absolutely, there's a way in which wall paint, right? Makeup as wall paint.
Yeah,
there's a way in which you can stride out into the world and feel something.
It's like a defense shield.
Yeah, absolutely. Putting your identity on.
Yes. No, I definitely feel the less sleep, the more eyeliner. Is that a note to go to our recommendations for this week?
Oh, good.
So this week we're recommending plays, are we?
Yes, yes, definitely.
What have you seen recently that people should go see?
I went to see a play called Labour of Love, which I claimed to myself and to a friend of the podcast, Jen Rayner, who came to the play with me. I claimed was sort of work because it was a play about the Labour Party. I really enjoyed it. It had Martin Freeman and Tamsin Gregan, who are excellent. I thought it was very interesting because it's a play about constituency in kind of the north of England, or in Derbyshire, I think, which has been Labour, you know, from 1997 onwards, has always been Labour, in fact. And there's an MP who has been brought in for a by-election just before Blair becomes leader of the Labour Party, Martin Freeman, and he's, you know, part of this kind of Blairite revolution within the Labour Party. And the play's kind of initially set in 2007 around 2017 around the recent election.
Oh, okay.
But is keeps going back in flashbacks. And the thing I found most interesting about it was that they used a lot of media clips and things like this to show going back in flashbacks. So they showed clips of Blair speaking, oh, wow, and Brown and all of these different things. The thing I found really interesting and slightly very irritating about it was that they kept kind of flashing up images and things and playing clips of people speaking. All of the Labour Party people speaking were men. And oh, initially, really? Initially I thought that was because it was always the leaders. But it wasn't always the leaders. They had other people talking as well. They had a picture of Sadiq Khan, for example, up at one point. But never, you didn't hear a single female voice, apart from Margaret Thatcher.
Was Jack Straw one of the people?
Was he one of the people speaking? I don't think he was. I think his image came up.
Because when I talked to him a few weeks ago, and he was talking about having been to a play where his image had been on. I think could be the same.
Yes, I'm sure his picture did come up, yes. But anyway, it's a good play. I would recommend it. It's politics and a love story.
Ooh.
Always good.
Excellent. My recommendation is Young Mox, which is at the Bridge Theatre by Tower Bridge in London.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit weird because I know someone who's in it, but I think this is a good enough play that even if you know someone who's in it, you'll forget that you know that person on stage. It is absolutely excellent. So it's about Mox when he's arrived in London. He's this destitute immigrant, mm-hmm, pursued by the police and spies, and he's really not getting down to any of the writing that Engels thinks he should do, and it's very well acted. It's a beautiful set. It works really well. It does several excellent things,
mm-hmm,
like point out how important the kind of collective work was around the making of Das Kapital.
Mm-hmm.
So it shows that women were drafting, you know, helping him draft, finding the right words.
Excellent.
And like actually physically sitting down at a table with Marx and doing the work with him. It also, one thing that I really liked myself was, as someone who is bilingual and, mm-hmm, operates in two languages, they do this excellent thing that when Marx and his German family members are meant to be speaking English, they speak English with German accents.
Mm-hmm.
But when they're behind closed doors or they're speaking to each other and they're meant to speak German,
mm-hmm,
they speak English with, you know, British accents.
Ah, clever.
So it kind of makes it clear, that, mm-hmm, kind of distinction for a lot of people who come to a new country and can't really express themselves succinctly, mm-hmm, but are geniuses behind closed doors. I think that was really well made. And that is actually, so I think this episode is going to be broadcast on the 5th of December,
yes,
if I remember correctly, if that's a Tuesday. And there is actually the opportunity to go and see Young Marx in the cinema on the 7th of December. So if anyone catches this in the first few days, you can go and see it around the country and around the world. My parents are actually going to go see it in my home city in Sweden, dedicated fans as they are. So yeah, I think that's a really good thing to do before Christmas. It runs until the 31st of December, so there might be time.
Excellent.
But yes.
Okay.
And next time is going to be a completely new podcast yes. theme, we are doing a Christmas special. Shall we? Let's not spoil the...
No, we're doing a Christmas special, which you will have to find out about by tuning in and listening to it. So yeah. you can, you know, follow us on Twitter, at TNKpod, follow us individually, watch out for our newsletter, go to our website.
And have a great time till you hear from us next.
Okay, bye.
Bye.